性比较足够。Give me 1 minute. Yeah. Friends. There is one thing which I did not mention and I should mention, and that this evening is organized not just by the David Cardoso Academy, but also by Torah in Motion, which is Professor Elliot Melamed, his community or his special academy, mainly in Toronto, but we are trying to do together things over here because in many ways we have a similar attitude to certain issues. If we have about this issue, I have no idea.
You ready? You ready to rock?
Welcome, sir.
Hi, good evening. I'm Dr. Elliot Melamed, and as Rabbi Cardozo said, on behalf of the Cardozo Academy and also Torah in Motion, welcome. It's really my pleasure to be in conversation once again with William Kohlbrenner, who's a professor of English literature at Bar Ilan. He's the author of Milton's Warring Angels, as well as work on Mary Astell. He's also the author of Open-Minded Torah on Irony, Fundamentalism, and Love. His latest book, The Last Rabbi, Joseph Soloveitchik and the Talmudic Tradition, was published a few months ago by Indiana University Press. It is a complex, difficult, and unique deconstruction of the topic, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Please welcome William Kohlbrenner. You know, Bill, you've written a lot of articles on Jewish topics, but I hear you've devoted yourself full length to Rabbi Soloveitchik. I'm interested in, A, why you're interested in writing on him, particularly in the kind of way that you do. And I'm also intrigued by the fact that, unlike much writing on him, you're not a student. You didn't attend Yeshiva University. You weren't part of that orbit. And you're offering a very different kind of lens on his work. So maybe you can take us a little bit through your thinking about why you wanted to write on this and in this way.
Well, as Elliot mentioned, when I was in graduate school, I was a graduate student in English literature. And I was very interested at the time in questions of pluralism and interpretive authority. That is, I'm writing about Milton in the 17th century. Milton is writing at a revolutionary period. There is a burst of energy related to individualism. And there's a question about how this individualism can be contained. I'm also at graduate school at Columbia in the 1980s. It's the time of high theory. Theorists, cultural critics are also thinking about the relationship between individualism and community, the way in which multiple meanings can survive in a community, or whether community can survive multiple kinds of meanings. And I remember going to a Beit Midrash with a friend of mine, and it was Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn. We sat down to learn Gemara, and I thought, these people are totally crazy. because there was no methodological introduction to what was happening. Subsequently, I found a book by Rabbi Soloveitchik called Halachic Man. And from that point on, I realized there was a person within the Jewish tradition who spoke the languages with which I was familiar. So through my engagement with his work, I began to address the very questions that I thought about in graduate school: pluralism, multiplicity, possibilities of multiple interpretation in relationship to Talmudic tradition and Talmudic argument. So I wrote many arguments on Talmudic hermeneutics. That's Talmudic interpretation, how to understand the principle that Rabbi Cardozo mentioned, these and these are the words of the living God, which by any philosophical standard doesn't really make any sense. And from there, I went on to write about Rabbi Soloveitchik's work. And I tried or thought at the time about writing a book that would show the continuity between Talmudic thought about interpretation and Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought about interpretation. I think we'll probably flesh that out a little bit more later. The question about not being a Yeshiva University student. There's something to be said for being within the hermeneutic circle, that is inside, to be an insider. And as I tell my students, whenever we study Milton or Aeschylus or Virgil, the hermeneutics of suspicion, that is an interpretive perspective which claims somehow that the critic knows more than the author, is a last-ditch resort. meaning we want to spend many, many hours, many days, many months, many years being on the inside and seeing things from an insider perspective. From one perspective, I revere the person who goes by the name of the Rav. And my family is here in Jerusalem, and I live here and work here in Israel, in many ways on account of that original engagement with Rav Soloveitchik. But during the course of my engagement with Rav Soloveitchik, and perhaps in trying to write a book that I never wrote, which would find the continuity between Talmudic tradition and Rabbi Soloveitchik on questions of knowledge and interpretation, instead of finding continuity, I found a kind of rupture. I found a kind of discontinuity. And I found, really, that the best kind of... I found myself addressing Rabbi Soloveitchik not as the Rav, and not even as Rabbi Soloveitchik, but as Soloveitchik. And it's not really, I think, in this room, and in me speaking as a professor, which is what I am, a sign of disrespect. To me, Soloveitchik is one of the major theologians of the 20th century. And I think by calling him only the Rav, and even the way he's published only by his students, does in a way a disservice to his reputation. Because instead of engaging with him critically, like we would any other great figure, there is a sense that when you're inside, there is that, Rabbi Cardoza calls it idolatry, but that reverence, I think also what gets left out, and I did not experience this firsthand, is that Rabbi Soloveitchik's charisma was extraordinary. And he had an extraordinary effect upon his listeners. So in some sense, in answer to your question, I think I'm at an advantage having not been a student of the Rav. It's like saying Paradise Lost should only be read by Puritans. The best critics of Milton's Paradise Lost happen to be Jews. And it may just be because they have a distance from the work that people who are inside don't have. And I think where there perhaps is an impulse for apologetics, to try to make sense of things or to try to whitewash things, a more honest, and I will not say objective, but an outsider's view, using languages outside of the languages that Rabbi Soloveitchik uses, I think are elucidative. And my not being at YU, in that sense again, I think was an advantage in that I was not part of that circle. And I think my book is complicated because some of the chapters are really written from the perspective of being inside the hermeneutic circle. The second half of the book is clearly not.
Let's pick up on some of the threads of what you're saying here. One of them being that what makes this book different is that it weaves together and employs multiple kinds of discourses that you almost never see in traditional books about traditional Jewish figures. And I mean by that, it's weaving in psychoanalysis, complex literary theory, and certain kinds of philosophical schools of thought, and actually trying to bring them into some kind of conversation with Rabbi Soloveitchik. But at the heart of the matter to me, and I actually did read the book, is that the key theme of the book is adopted from an essay by Freud in 1917, which is called Mourning and Melancholia. And in your introduction, you refer to Rabbi Soloveitchik as a melancholy modern, right? Which is a very striking phrase, a melancholy modern as opposed to what you call the mourning rabbis of the Talmud. So what I'd like you to do is take us through and explain what is, first of all, Freud referring to in this binary between mourning and melancholy, and how you've adopted this for the work on a 20th century Orthodox rabbi. Mm-hmm.
Well, Freud wrote the essay 1915, which was in the middle of World War I. And for him, the essay Mourning and Melancholy, like subsequent essays that he would write during that decade, was really a form of mourning for a civilization that he felt was about to be lost. So although he's writing clearly in psychoanalytic terms about family relationships and family dynamics, it's also a form of mourning for a culture that would be lost. It's interesting that when Soloveitchik entertains the same ideas, he's writing in the 1940s when civilization is being lost, and perhaps more definitively, yet again. When Freud writes about melancholy, for him, and this may be an ideal that can never be reached, melancholy is, mourning is a, for Freud, is a healthy relationship to loss. Of course, loss and trauma can be just that, traumatic. But the question is it possible to move forward from loss? For me, the rabbis of the Talmud thematized this issue in relationship to questions of interpretation. And how they do that is describing, in many examples, the death of Moses. Moses dies, and in each one of the stories recounted in Tamura, Moses dies, and then laws are forgotten. Halachot are forgotten. So there's a relationship between mourning and loss. When Moses is no longer present, there are many other stories, in which Yeshua is asked, recapture that loss for us. The answer to that in most cases is, Lo b'shamayim hi. God answers him, it's not in heaven, I gave it to you. For the rabbis considering Moses' death, the question of loss is whether it can be recuperated. For Freud, recuperation means going back into the past, but also being able to go into the future. A partial leave-taking of the past. That's Freud's language. I leave the past, but only partially. I'm still connected to it. In our terms or Soloveitchik's terms, that's tradition. But I'm not so fixated on the past that I can't go forward. Partial leave-taking of the past to go into the future. People who only are in the future and repress the past never really get to mourn. So it's another version of unhealthy mourning. For the rabbis of the Talmud, the discussions of Moses and his death and loss are really about interpretation. Talmudic texts, Amoraim in relationship to Tanaim, the questions always are asked is, what does this mean? There's always a kind of lacuna, a blank, an empty space. And from that comes multiplicity. Meaning, once I have a blank space, is the halacha like Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Yehuda? Now, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, they both have legitimate opinions. If they didn't both have legitimate opinions, then one of them would go away. There's something intrinsic about meaning, and this seems to be what the Gemara recognizes, which produces in the face of loss, plural and multiple meanings. One of the stories about Moses' death is Moses dies, the laws are forgotten, and Atniel comes. Atniel is one of the judges. Atniel comes and he is able to recuperate the laws through appeal pool, through dialectics. That is, through his own creative instincts, he's able to create the laws anew. And they're not necessarily the same exact laws that had been forgotten at the time of Moses. So that's the conception of healthy mourning, relating to loss and moving forward, going back into the past so one can go into the future. And this means, in my understanding of rabbinic mourning, that one is satisfied with only partial interpretations. It's a famous philosopher, Hilary Putnam, was in Jerusalem, died recently, and he used to say, enough may not be everything, but enough is enough. And to me, that's a motto for rabbinic interpretation. Enough may not be everything, but enough is enough. That is, we talk about interpretations, or to put it in kind of a psychoanalytic idiom, there are good enough interpretations. There are never perfect interpretations. That's healthy mourning. For Freud, melancholy involves the inability to mourn healthily. There's still a desire for that lost object. The desire for that lost object, I'm speaking Freudian language, an object is person. The desire for the person who is lost is so great that one becomes inconsolable. And the only way for mourning for this traumatic experience of longing to be alleviated is to find refuge in something else. I can't link up with the Shekhinah, as Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks of in a theological work. Freud will talk about his friend who has an oceanic feeling, a desire for union with the creation or the creator. Soloveitchik, for many reasons, sees that that's impossible. So instead of In lieu of that kind of merging, Soloveitchik takes refuge in a kind of interpretation which is absolute. And we see in his later work that Soloveitchik will vacillate between two perspectives. Of course, halachic man, we know, halachic man is the man of conquest. We think of Rav Chaim, probably modeled, the model for halachic man. The noble, unflappable man of conquest, unruffled by emotion. Then think about Rabbi Soloveitchik and his late works. Goes in front of 2,000 people and he says, I am lonely. Celebrates his emotional life. Celebrates defeat. Now it's not conquest, but rather defeat that's important. Where the rabbis talk about interpretation, that's multiple. There are different perspectives. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I think this is where he takes a philosophical turn, a Kantian turn, a Cartesian turn, Soloveitchik in a way becomes an Enlightenment figure in the Jewish tradition. You either have everything, complete conquest, I know everything, or nothing. So there's a vacillation between total conquest, total meaning, and then complete desolation and desperation. When Rabbi Soloveitchik did...
I was going to pop in and try and tie the threads together. So yeah. You have two terms here.
Yeah.
Mourning, which is the capacity to let go. In other words, there's a loss, you can let it go, and letting it go, you can move forward. And melancholy, which is the failure, in a sense, to let go. In other words, to be stuck. And I think that the connection you're making is that on a rabbinic level, Moses represents the kind of pure, perfect point of halacha. You don't have to argue. You don't have to dispute it. It is one. It is. Right. This is it.
Right.
But then he dies. So you lose it. You lose, in a sense, the one real connection to God. You lose the pure law. And what you're left with, all you're left with, is the ability to interpret. So the way you're analyzing the rabbis is that the rabbis are actually able to mourn successfully by letting go of the fantasy that we can get the pure halacha, the pure truth. And that's actually the genesis of interpretation, that once you let go of, I will never know the pure truth, you can allow yourself to now have multiple interpretations of things, so that there's an equation you're making between a healthy Freudian mourning. You're actually saying that the rabbis exemplify that, that the act of interpretation is the sign that you've mourned successfully because you're not stuck on, I want that truth back, and if I can't get it, I can't go forward. And they're able to actually move forward by letting go of that desire, that fantasy for absolute truth, and being able to interpret. Whereas melancholy, the stuck person, is the one who cannot console themselves about the loss of truth and therefore, in a way, cannot open themselves up to multiple perspectives because multiple perspectives, in a way, signify the loss of that absolute truth. What I'd like you to clarify a little bit is this connection between Rabbi Soloveitchik and melancholy. In what way is he stuck? In what way does his reflections on Judaism and Jewish law reflect the person who cannot move past it, who can't go forward?
Rabbi Soloveitchik tells a story which his editors kind of dismiss as a charming story about Rabbi Soloveitchik's childhood. He's in his grandfather's living room in a place called Pruzhna, am I pronouncing that correctly? And his grandfather is Eliyahu Feinstein. His father is surrounded by Talmidim. He's described as Rabbi Moses in the book. And Rabbi Moses is stuck with an interpretive crux, something he can't solve. He starts to look despairingly at his Talmidim, pulls at his beard, and then miraculously the light shines, and he's able to solve the kasha, the question that the Rambam presents. Soloveitchik himself, sitting on a bed outside of this circle, and when Rabbi Moses solves the problem, everybody in the room is joyful. They're they're just jubilant. Interestingly, in the story, the young Joseph, as he describes himself, runs to his mother's room and says, "Father, solve the problem of the Rambam." That is, in the moment of emotional celebration, he goes to his mother. Again, total conquest. And the story is Rabbi Moses comes in the service of Rabbi Moses. Rabbi Moses Soloveitchik comes in the service of the Rambam, Maimonides, who is coming in the service of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, and it's like an intergenerational conquest and triumph. That's one story. It's like a diptych, a painting diptych. The second story is, same scene, same kind of problem, but this time he fails. And the room falls into utter despair.
As Rabbi Soloveitchik's father fails to solve the Rambam problem.
Yeah, this time Rabbi Moses fails. And there's total desolation. Everybody is distraught. The young Joseph describes himself as sitting on his bed with Maimonides, and they're crying together. Instead of intergenerational triumph, it's intergenerational catastrophe. This time again, runs to his mother's room. She consoles him and says, "Don't worry, one day you'll grow up and maybe you'll solve the problems of your father." It's interesting that uncertainty in this story is located in the realm of the feminine. That is, for Soloveitchik, the masculine always is the realm of certainty. And when we don't have that certainty, there's despair and catastrophe. So why he's stuck is he's stuck again in this pendulum between the total conquest of full knowledge represented in the first half of the story and the absolute not knowing of the second half of the story. And the uncertainty that seems to be built into the legal process of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. When Rabbi Soloveitchik writes about interpretation, he never writes about that. Maybe once. I'm not talking about his practice. I'm not talking about what he did in the Shiurim. When he writes about interpretation, he's not at all interested in pluralism. So it seems that he's stuck on this model of going back and forth. Was there something more you wanted to ask me about that?
I'm curious. Yeah. You're arguing a kind of emotional, almost sort of psychoanalytic origin.
Yeah.
For him getting stuck. He's so distraught at the idea that this problem can't be solved. Mm. In other words, he can't mourn the problem. He can't mourn the idea that we don't have an solution to the problem. I guess what you're saying in terms of Freudian mourning is that if he could mourn it, he could sort of with sanguinely accept the idea that we can have multiple possibilities and just leave it at that. Just leave open the idea of an open-ended interpretation to halakha.
Well, which seems to be the way the Gemara works in most cases. And that may be the way many of his shirim work.
But the distress leads to the idea of, no, I have to stick with conquest. Mm. How does that manifest? I guess I'm thinking about examples in his work. You named one. That he doesn't seem to be attuned or doesn't seem interested in the Elu ve'Elu argument in hermeneutics. But are there examples of halakhic decisions or philosophical comments that he makes that suggest that he's unable to let go of that kind of underlying fantasy to get back that pure truth or that pure presence? Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another story. Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about being in the same room as Rabbeinu Tam and in Rashi. I think Rabbi Cardoza was talking about this also, a kind of idealized tradition away from the particularity of this worldly thought. I think all of his ethical writings are really based upon this sense of mourning and suffering. I mean, mourning or melancholy and suffering function really strangely in his work. In the story that I told you about Prujna, he's crying, he's weak, he's vulnerable. In other places, when he recounts his childhood, he's suffering, he's crying, he feels shame in front of his father, he feels that halacha is this burden that is painful, it's almost this language of masochism or sadism, halakha being this terrible, terrible burden, this terrible suffering. And that in the context of his ancestors, who don't seem to relate at all to suffering. For example, the same Rav Eliyahu Feinstein, before his daughter is on her deathbed, and he runs and hastens to put on tefillin before she dies. It's really just told as this very cold, cold story. So in the context of that, Rabbi Soloveitchik is this young man running to his mother, feeling this emotional suffering. Later in his career, the very suffering that he experiences becomes a sign of chosenness. And in that way, I mean, part of my argument in relationship to Soloveitchik and maybe Freud is that in order for Soloveitchik to become himself, in some way he does have to kill his father off. Or he has to change, he has to kill off the halachic man and become a different version of that halachic man. Soloveitchik models himself after Moses. In Soloveitchik's rendering, and I'm sure there's stuff in the Medrash about this, in Soloveitchik's representation, Moses is a man of suffering, feeling bereft, feeling bankrupt. An image of Moses like the great existential man at the bottom of his depression. And only because of that suffering does Moses merit revelation. For Soloveitchik himself, it's suffering, and this is again how he distinguishes himself from his ancestors, it's suffering that is the precondition for a certain kind of ethical thinking. So it's almost as if, and we haven't mentioned repentance, which I think is really central to Soloveitchik's thought. Repentance, I think the way Soloveitchik describes it, I mean, it's extremely complicated, he writes on a great deal, is a kind of a way of rewriting your own personal story. Taking the facts of the past and rewriting them in a new narrative. I think that's just what he does in his later writing, is the suffering that was this desolation, this feeling of absolute loneliness and shame in relationship to his father becomes, for him later in his life, a sign of chosenness. So this melancholy that he feels functions in different ways. In an ethical context, it becomes this sign of chosenness. And in a way, Soloveitchik's Moses is very much like Freud's Moses, an ethical man. It functions in another way, in an interpretive context, as never being satisfied. I never can get that lost object back, as he said. I can't get back to it. I long for it. I mean, the rabbis knew that the people of Israel would long for that pure meaning. In one of the stories, Moses dies, people of Israel go to Joshua, and they say, ask, and he won't do it. So they decide they're going to kill Joshua. Now, that's the Gemara. Freud said that the people of Israel wanted to kill Moses for giving them the law. The rabbis say that the people of Israel wanted to kill Joshua because he wouldn't be a replacement. We want another Moses. That the rabbis understood that we have this kind of fundamentalist urge. We want to go to that pure truth. And for Soloveitchik, because he can't have all, there's that melancholy feeling of nothingness. Again, it functions for him ethically in a different kind of way as a sign of chosenness.
It strikes me that you're describing almost two people, right? Mm. You have one person, the Rabbi Soloveitchik of Halacha, halachic man, yeah, who's working kind of, as Rabbi Cardozo alluded to before, meta-historically, right? I'm not going to acknowledge change. The halakha is kind of going to float above history. And I think you're seeing that as a form of stuckness, right? You're seeing that as a form of melancholy that I can't let go of the idea of an absolute, unchanging truth. And I'm not going to give way to kind of pluralist interpretation. So that's sort of Rabbi Soloveitchik 1, if I understand
right.
you. But you're also saying that something happened to him in his life where there was a change in later ethical writing in Al Tshuva, in Out of the Whirlwind, and so on, where if not fully embracing mourning, he's allowing for a certain kind of change. Mm-hmm. Right? In Al Tshuva, he's talking about a kind of flexibility of time where you can go back to your past, you can become a new person. there's a wonderful phrase from a scholar here in Israel, Mordechai Rotenberg, who talks about, I hope to have a good past. right, in which your present actions can rewrite how you even think about the past. That Rabbi Soloveitchik II that you're discussing seems more fluid, doesn't seem as stuck. Are you saying that in law he always remained melancholic, and with ethics and his personal meditations about change in one's life, he could move a little bit towards mourning?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the in both his writings about tshuva and then his writings about ethics, there is an acknowledgement of multiplicity. That is, when he writes in his ethical writings, when he's not writing in the realm of the halacha, when he's not writing in that masculine realm, when he embraces sometimes a feminine language, and interestingly, Rabbi Soloveitchik associates a certain kind of memory, quotes the French philosopher Bergson, a certain kind of memory is needed for the process of repentance. It's called, he calls it an event memory, a qualitative memory. There's another kind of memory, which Bergson calls a quantitative memory. And he says that the former, the qualitative memory, is both a blessing and a curse. And in his semi-autobiographical descriptions, he associates that memory, the qualitative memory, with his mother. And the quantitative memory, naturally, with the halakhic man who is sees the world through physical realms, with his father. It's an interesting aside. But in the realm of ethics and also of tshuva, he represents what I would call multiple agencies. What do I mean by multiple agencies? In ethics, I mean, it's more obvious, there's the sense of the need to recognize the other. So I'm sounding like Levinas now, right? The need to recognize the other. Example that Rabbi Soloveitchik gives, in Deuteronomy, there's the injunction to go to Jerusalem to celebrate during the pilgrimage. And Rabbi Soloveitchik goes on to say, but of course there's the tithe that you have to give to the poor. At the very moment that you are celebrating, there is still the consciousness of the opposite emotion, the opposite perspective. There are people in need. T.S. Eliot said of 17th century poetry, or 17th century poets, that 17th century poets were able to see in one experience the possibility of other experiences. That is, in this kind of multiplicity of perspectivism, which is the very thing that gets repressed in his writings about interpretation, he expands upon in his writing about ethics. And I would say really the same thing for tshuva. In order, as you said, to have a good past, there's a sense in which, I mean, there are two kinds of tshuva, tshuva out of love and tshuva out of fear. Tshuva out of fear is, I just reject my past. I'm so disgusted by my past, I reject it. Maybe that's the tshuva, I think, implicitly in his work, which is associated with halachic men. Then the other kind of tshuva, tshuva out of love, is, as you say, where I embrace my past. And I get into conversation with my past. I let my past speak, as it were. And that implies kind of agencies of the psyche. Sounds a lot like Freud, right? Freud's famous comment is where it was, ego will be. Where the past was, I will one day be. Soloveitchik is a very, very similar sense. That is, I will my present self will be transformed by the past. But again, in order to have a nice past, I have to let that past speak. So there's that sense of more than one agency, an agency of whatever Freudian metaphors you could use, an agency of my past, however derelict and horrible it is. That's tshuva. There's the tshuva out of fear, in which I just say I have nothing to do with that. Tshuva out of love is, I think this is for Soloveitchik, his most compelling, obviously, for him, is where you rewrite the past, allowing it to speak in a different way. So there becomes a kind of interpsychic dialogue between the parts of the psyche.
So the mourner, once the mourner allows the past to speak, in other words, let's say you suffer a great loss.
Right.
So the unhealthy model would be, you never want to talk about it, you never want to think about it again, it's banished, but it isn't really banished.
Well, that's one. The other one is, right, all I can do is talk about
it. Or all I can do is talk about it. I can never get past it, either by never talking about it, by always talking about it.
Which are the same thing, really.
So that's the melancholic, right? The person who's stuck either by never identifying or just obsessing about it always, right? You seem to be arguing that up to a certain point in his life, that's him, and that's him. And the way we know that's him is because of the way he writes about law. The fact that he writes about law in this kind of above history way, a kind of static way, you're positing, is suggesting almost the personality of the melancholic who can never get past, who can never allow things to evolve and change, and this gets manifested legally. What I'm interested then is that you are arguing, though, that at a certain point in his life, some sort of mourning, if we define mourning as allowing things to be a little bit more fluid, I can move a bit, enters. I'm wondering, is there an historical point? In other words, is there a point where this mastery of cognition gives way? You do mention in the book that he has a medical problem and an operation in the late 1950s. And I'm wondering if this kind of what you call humility, he enters into a kind of phase of epistemological humility. Is the halakha defeated by life at that point? In other words, was this a crisis? Is there now a later Soloveitchik that comes into view because of this personal suffering, and because of this personal suffering, he's able to let go a little bit of that being stuck model.
Before I answer the question you just asked, I want to go back a second to explaining a little bit the frustration of mourning. There's a French critic of the 70s, Julia Kristeva, who talks about not being able to lose. And Soloveitchik, I think, falls into that category, not knowing how to lose. And in the face of loss, Kristeva writes, there's an attempt at compensation. And that compensation she terms the law, and by law she means culture, art, also law. That since I can't have the thing I really want, I compensate for it in other ways, through language. For Kristeva, she writes, the compensation is never enough. It's never sufficient. There's always that longing for the thing that I can't have. And I think that's true of Soloveitchik as well. And this is the ambivalence of Soloveitchik as halachic man. For Soloveitchik, Kristeva's law is the halacha. And in some sense, it really never is enough. There's always that desire for something else. There's always that desire for something out there, represented, I think, again, in the feminine, in what the warmth it offers, the emotion it offers.
Which means what? In other words, you're saying there's something that can never be compensated for. It's the pure origin thing. It's like when people say, if I can't have God, you know, everything else is a substitution.
Right.
For him, what's the thing that got lost? And what's the thing he stuck?
I think in his own philosophical language, it's really pure presence.
God.
Immanence. The immanence of God. And maybe that's because he learned with Chabad. I mean, immanence versus transcendence. Is God immanent or transcendent? Soloveitchik would love to embrace the immanent God. He would love to be Spinoza, but he can't because it raises lots of ethical problems. Meaning once you embrace immanence, once you embrace an idea that God is in everything, it raises problems of, well, you know, what is the locus of morality? Where does law come from? So I think that's his desire for that purity. And he can never have it. Now, you asked before about what brings him back to life. And I think it is that sense of mortality. At a point in the footnotes of Halachic Man, which I read, he talks about Rudolf Otto, German philosopher, and something that he calls the trace of the divine. That there's something that the Halachic Man cannot account for. There's something outside of his interpretive matrix. And that is just, I guess, he talks about an out of the whirlwind mystery. The thing, the sublime. The things that are beyond language. I think maybe that's perhaps one way of thinking about Soloveitchik, is there is a sense maybe of mortality, but also a sense of the sublimity or the mystery of life, things that cannot be included in the matrix of the halachic man. There are things beyond it. I mean, he always says that. Even in his early writings, there's always a sense there's something else there. There's something else behind it, which he can't get to. And that becomes more acute, I think, in his later writings, which is, I think, a great way of putting it. It's a kind of epistemological humility.
So the not being able to get to it, I can't get to God.
Yeah.
God is lost. I'm curious whether, is it that God was there and got lost, or God is always never present? Mm. And I'm mourning the fact that, and I think this is a feeling that many people have, like all the time, which is this feeling you do Jewish life, you do mitzvot, you learn, but underneath it all, there's this vague suspicion of what's underneath it. Is there anything underneath it? Because, you know, we don't see God, we don't touch God, we don't hear from God unless we're
crazy.
And there's this feeling of this dissonance of I'm anxious about that. I want to believe that this all adds up to something, but what if it doesn't? And what if underneath there is no presence there? And are you saying that that inchoate feeling was so internalized in him that there was a kind of compensation? If I can't get God, I'm going to make this halakha so pure and so strict and so unstinting that it is the thing that is going to try and compensate for that.
Even though it never fully does.
Right. And it's interesting because his son, Chaim Soloveitchik, at the end of his really celebrated essay, Rupture and Reconstruction, says almost exactly the same thing. I'm going to read to you a passage from that because it's so apropos, right? The Rav's son, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, writes an article in 1994 called Rupture and Reconstruction, in which he tries to account for the orthodoxy that he sees today, a kind of stricter kind of orthodoxy. Mm. He recalls that in previous generations, people learned how to be Jewish by looking at their parents, by being at home. And now people learn it out of books. And books are always stricter. Books always default to the strictest position. He goes into a very, very dense detail about this and concludes with the following. He says, I think it is safe to say that the perception of God as a daily natural force is no longer present to a significant degree in any sector of modern Jewry, even the most religious. It is this rupture in traditional religious sensibilities that underlies much of the transformation of contemporary orthodoxy. Zealous to continue traditional Judaism unimpaired, religious Jews seek to ground their new emerging spirituality less on a now unattainable intimacy with God than on an intimacy with his will. Having lost the touch of his presence, they seek now solace in the pressure of his yoke.
Yeah, that's
and that's how the essay ends. Yeah. And it's striking me here, kind of like father, like son.
Yeah.
Are you arguing that that's in a way how the Rav felt, that there was always this feeling that something's gone or never was?
Right. I mean, there's so many things you've said are so suggestive. The pleasures of the yoke, I mean, to me, the lady doth protest too much.
It's the pressure of the yoke.
Oh, the pressure of the yoke.
Yeah,
for Soloveitchik, it's sometimes the pleasure. The pleasure and the incomplete compensation. I'm sorry. I
guess what I'm asking is that, in a sense, what he does and what we do in Jewish life is
right.
We use this kind of law and strictness of law
right.
as a way of covering over the fact that...
Well, I would just change his terms a little bit. And this, I mean, I think he's speaking as a Brisker, the law, the chok. I think if I were to do a contemporary analysis of the Jewish world, which is not what I'm here for, but I'll do it anyway, it's not just the halacha. There's halacha on the one side, so everybody's in the Haredi world in a halacha kola learning halacha. But then there's the other side, which is the mysticism. Meaning, and there's this kind of crazy extreme mysticism on the one hand, and then the other hand is this dry halacha, and they don't really meet in any place. But I think the question you're asking, which is to me an interesting one, is this phenomenon, is it melancholy moderns, or are we always in this position of being melancholy? I just was teaching Paradise Lost this afternoon, and Adam and Eve getting thrown out of Eden, and right before they leave, the archangel Michael says to them, that even though God, you're not going to walk in the garden with God anymore, but when you go out into the world, God will be as here, It's a, you know, lovely, it's kind of like the birth of language and signification interpretation. God is as here and present through his signs. Now, for Milton, whatever, 300 years ago, that was enough. The signs themselves are enough. For Soldati, that doesn't seem ever to be enough, right? There, and so I think there's a kind of particular melancholy that comes in the 20th century, figures like Walter Benjamin as well, this sense of kind of, I give up on the mystics, so I have to rely upon the compensation of stories, law, language, whatever.
Is he self-conscious about the substitution? By that I mean, you recognize it as a sign, and you're self-conscious that it's a sign, right? You're opening up the Torah, you're reading it. It's supposed to be the sign of God, but the very fact that it's the Torah and not God proves to you that it's a sign, right?
Right, like, it's immediate.
So this is what Emily Bronte writes about gravestones, that when you're at the gravestone, you're there supposedly to be, this is the person. But of course, it's not the person, because it's the stone. The sign itself proves that presence is not here, right? Derrida says the sign is always a sign of the fall, meaning that in Eden, Adam had God. But after Eden, all we have are signs of God. We don't have God, right? So is he aware that of the signification that the law and all that comes with it is a proof that God is not actually there? Or are you just making that argument and he's not so self-conscious?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the question is, what consolation would we get out of signs? I mean, Soloveitchik talks when he writes about quantum physicists who are kind of the heroes of halachic mind. He says that even they feel this kind of despair, that their concepts are only concepts and are somehow removed from the reality that they're trying to describe. So there he is, self-consciously or not, describing that sense of distance. It's interesting that his ancestor, Rav Chaim of Elazhin, has maybe the same kind of ideas about knowledge and being. I mean, Chaim of Elazhin, he adopts the ontology conceptions of being from the Kabbalist, all the Sfirot. But he says ultimately, you can't really know them. Meaning there's this ontology, there is this world, and you can't really know them, so all you can't have access to them, so we rely upon concepts or signs. Rav Chaim of Elazhin is this, to me, this exuberant thinker, celebrating the individual. You know, 200 years later, you have Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he's got the same kind of worldview about knowledge, and he's in absolute despair. So maybe there is something historically specific about, personally specific, historically specific about the kind of melancholy, the kind of absence that we feel in the 21st century or the 20th century.
Well, so if we extrapolate from all Jews, everybody in this room, everybody in the Jewish world, essentially has to decide between mourning and melancholy. In other words, if you're a person who finds the absence of God inconsolable, I can't do this religion thing if I don't have God in my living room, right? Everything, it's just a sham. It's just all substitution, and I can't let go of that. And in a way, you're in a melancholic state, in a sense, of whether you can actually embrace religion, whereas the mourner, in a way, accepts the compensation, right?
Yes.
Right. What does Freud say about the melancholic? He can't chew the food,
right?
Like as a substitution for loss, and so you have to be able to chew the religious food in order to accept the fact that God's not here. Mm. But what we have is we have Torah, we have mitzvah, we have community, we have everything else, but we don't have the thing. Mm-hmm. Can I live Jewishly without that thing there?
Well, I mean, I go back to Milton. It's a little bit like going when they get thrown out of Eden. They are left with signs, and if they're going to live, they're going to have to interpret. And in Milton, there's a certain kind of satisfaction, obviously, with the sign. And the question is, how much consolation do we get from that? If we want from the sign everything, well, we'll never be happy. And my argument about mourning rabbis is that they were, in fact, they were comfortable with the consolations of the sign. They were comfortable with the consolations of good enough interpretations in the plural.
Was halacha not meant originally to be the way how to draw God into our day-to-day life? Was that not the ultimate purpose behind it, which got lost in a later stage?
Right, but what you celebrate, I think, is actually quite disappointing if you think about it. If you think about pluralism, what it really means, it could be this and it could be that.
Right.
If you're living a life where you want to know, what is it really? What is it, really? You don't want this and that. Mm-hmm. You don't want elu ve'elu. You don't want, like, well, the law could be this, the law could be that. If the law is a reflection of divine will, I don't want like, well, maybe this, maybe that. So what is that God? You want it, you want that capital T truth. Now, I think there's a kind of post facto accommodation, right? I see pluralism almost as a post facto accommodation to the loss of presence. And as such, we celebrate it, right? But does anybody in their right mind really not want the real thing, unless the real thing is so overwhelming that really you don't.
Well,
that
that's also true. I mean, in Soloveitchik, when he does imagine the real thing,
it's scary.
It's scary, and the feminine is promising, but also it threatens to be overwhelming. But I don't know. I mean, yeah, we do want the real thing, but you know, maybe there's a consolation of something like the virtual Beit Midrash. Somebody said that. It's not my coinage. The virtual Beit Midrash, in which we relate to each other and we look at truth as a communal enterprise, as something that we're. I mean, that's really what the ideal yeshiva should be, when we're in this, as Milton says, the process of adding truth to truth. You know, Milton says, again, I'm a Miltonist, he says, he who thinks we are to pitch our tent here, he who thinks we have already arrived, that person is far from the truth. I think that's what Chazal think. If you say you have the truth, you're far from the truth. Why? Because truth, by definition, is something that can only be collectively known. I mean, I need to be in conversation with others. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying. The fundamentalist urge is strong, but you know, I think there are more consolations of pluralism.
But he's ironically then kind of in conflict with the Talmudic rabbis. There's something remarkably ironic.
Well, that's why I couldn't write the book that I wanted to write, because I wanted to write a book about a look. There's this neat continuity between ancient and modern rabbis, the modern rabbi being Soloveitchik, and I found, no, it's rupture.
Is God not the pluralist?
I don't have to ask him.
In the way how he appears within the Jewish tradition, with all the contradictions.
Right. Requires different.
And is that indeed not possible to live by that?
That's not anything. There's no there there. Humans project a pluralism in the face of that loss, which is fine. I think it's actually a very logical maneuver, but we celebrate it, and communities construct it. I just, before we throw it open to the floor, want to ask you just a little historical question, because you talked about, Freud mourning civilization in the First World War, the Rab mourning civilization in the Second World War. There's also the accompanying historical timeline of the what I call the kind of background hum of modernity, which is this idea of the loss of God, right? From Blake, really, to Nietzsche, right through the 20th century, there's this feeling that God is not there, that there's no presence. And I'm wondering if you feel that Rabbi Soloveitchik isn't just responding to kind of mosaic loss, but the feeling all around him that the culture sort of pushing this idea that God isn't here anymore.
Right.
And is he in kind of heroic resistance to that?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. It's something I have to think more about. I think maybe part of it is a result of 17th century philosophy. figures like Hobbes, figure like Spinoza, this kind of 17th century obsession with being, which is new. A philosophical language in which I want to have access to being in some sense. And I think that holds out philosophically that promise. The short answer to your question is really, I don't know, and it's something I really have to think about more. Is Soloveitchik part of just this project of modernity? How much is it specific to where he's coming from? I think that's a great question. So maybe we should.
Question which I would like to ask you is, does the Holocaust not play a tremendous role here without being mentioned? Mm. In other words, the incredible emphasis on halakha is basically to run away from the Holocaust and its theological problems which we cannot solve. So we are replacing our problems somewhere else. Okay. Let's make another halachic problem so we don't need to deal with the issue of religion or faith in God and trust in God after something like that happened.
I mean, you can't really blame. I mean, in a way, you can't blame him, right? I mean,
no, there's nothing to blame.
I mean, you mentioned. I mean, I'm just saying that the trauma is so new. Right. I mean, you were talking before about Rabbi Sachs's Hesped of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he talks about the centrality of the Holocaust and that feeling of loss in his work. And he talks about Rabbi Soloveitchik as, again, as you're saying, coming to America, or you're saying, and kind of heroically continuing the tradition, and being a kind of first rabbi in America, which I'll just say begs the question Rabbi Cardoza referred to the title of my book, which is The Last Rabbi. And the reason I call him the last rabbi and not the first rabbi as Rabbi Sacks is because Rabbi Soloveitchik, I think, imagined himself as this very, very lonely figure, obviously. And just like he sees himself in, as a mirror of Moses, in other places as a mirror of Abraham, he reads all of the Avot through this lens of absolute, utter despair and loneliness. I lost my train of thought. You want to help me out here?
I have that moment every day, most of the day.
Yeah. The last rabbi. Right. That must be a Freudian slip of some sort. So why not the first rabbi and why the last rabbi? Because Rabbi Soloveitchik confessed in an article in the 50s that he did not feel he was a good rabbi to his students, that he did not convey the warmth that a rabbi in Israel should convey. And I think that Rabbi Soloveitchik so embraced the idea of being in the Chadash, not in Halacha, but as a person, that he created, or it's like he created a tradition that couldn't be continued. I mean, I know if there are any Talmidim of the Rav here, they'll tell you probably he had no idea what he was doing with the philosophers. He used to go uptown to whatever. He used to go downtown to Columbia to talk to the philosophers. We had no idea what he was doing. Meaning there was a separation between what he did in Shir and what he did outside of Shir. And I think it's crucial that he says, I couldn't convey warmth to my students. And that's, again, this emphasis on the feminine, that he became so idiosyncratic that he had no Talmidim. Just like Moses, just like Elisha at the end of Lonely Man of Faith. Just a figure who's so individuated that he doesn't have any true followers. I don't know if he's criticizing his followers or criticizing himself. I don't know.
I'm going to be throwing it open to the floor
now. Questions,
A couple of ground rules. Number one, speak loudly and clearly and make it a question and make it succinct, please.
Yeah.
But before that, I'd like you to all give Professor Goldbrenner a warm hand.
Thank you.
You stand and go ahead.
So much of what we've heard, everything of what we've heard, most of what's been written has been the Rav Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. Nobody ever talks about the Rav Soloveitchik of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that my conception, what I've heard is totally opposite of what you just said. He was warm. He did have a community.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, I would just emphasize that I'm not a biographer. I didn't know Rabbi Soloveitchik. I'm interested in his representations. That's what I mean. How does he represent interpretation? How does he represent ways of knowing? I'm happy and ready to learn from all of the students of Rabbi Soloveitchik about his life, but I'm stuck with his writings. So that's what I'm basing what I wrote on. So I'm grateful for your comment. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yes, Stan, please.
You mentioned the Holocaust, and you mentioned the change. You said he was from Isha Halacha, he went down, then came ethics. And I wonder to what extent Israel played a role in that as well. I think of Koldo Dido Fake, where he talks about how he changed from, he came from a background, a very Haredi background, anti-Zionist, and then moved and he recognized Yehud, etc. And I wonder what role that may have played.
That's very interesting. I mean, and also in Koldo Didofek, he gives his own theodicy. The theodicy is justifying the ways of God to man. That's Milton. And it's a very weak theodicy. It's basically, it's a brisk theodicy, which is, I don't know. He says, I can't, and of course, probably people know here that Rabbi Soloveitchik says you can't ask the why question, that is, why do men suffer, but rather the what question, and maybe that's related to your insight, that in the face of the Holocaust, you ask not why did this happen, but what can I do, and part of what can I do is helping establish the state of Israel.
The truth about it is that Rabbi Soloveitchik was a Haredi. In his attitude towards many things, he was a Haredi, but he was a Zionist at the same time, which made him an exceptional situation, put him in an exceptional situation. But in his thinking, he was very much part of the Haredi world.
Your last few words are a little puzzling. I think I heard you say that he didn't have many followers.
I didn't say that.
Students.
Huh?
Students.
So let me,
well, say what you said.
No, so I mean, the gentleman in the back pointed out that in Boston, he was surrounded by people and surrounded by students. And I'm sure if some of his students were here, they would object even more vigorously than you did. Again, I'm interested not in his... I'm not taking it personally. I just said I'm not a biographer. I don't know. I never met him. I'm interested in his writings. Like I said before, I think that's part of the advantage, is that he represents himself in his writings as a failure. Why is that? That's the question I ask.
I mean,
I'm not going to say, well, in real life he was something different. Okay.
Yeah. You did say it.
Yeah.
But I think you meant something by it. In other words, I think you meant that in terms of a true student, nobody really was able to incorporate that kind of emotional and historical complexity and in the sense of really being unique in the sense of the way he was unique. In other words, they were followers, perhaps, but not... not
this is exactly what Norman Lamb told me.
So I think that's what you meant.
I mean, they didn't love him? Yeah.
Well, I think it was about... Yes, sir, please. Yes.
The Rav writes in Lonely Land of Faith, he pretty explicitly describes the loneliness he's describing as not a anything that could be described by Freud as a subjective psychological state, but rather some objective existential aspect of the universe, as it were.
So what's the question?
Question is, it seemed to me that the Rav would disagree with your interpretation.
I'm sure he will. I think part of my argument is that I'll say two things. Maybe you would disagree, but the Rav's project is deeply influenced by Freud. That is, whenever the Rav in Halachic Man is talking about desire, he's saying, I recognize the same desires that Freud does, and I'm going to show not how they lead to, in the Rav's mind, degradation, but how they can be sublimated, how they can be picked up, how they can better be, not the Freudian term, how they can be elevated. So I would say that Freud is very much on Rav Soloveitchik's mind. I would also say that the essay Mourning and Melancholy is very much on Rabbi Soloveitchik's mind, and he writes explicitly against that argument without naming the argument. And to me, it's another case of the lady doth protest too much. That, I mean, the argument is too complicated for me to describe now. It is something that I deal in with my book. I think that, you know, 1932, Rabbi Soloveitchik arrives in Boston. That's the year Freud and Einstein are having a correspondence about peace. The next month, Einstein is moving to Princeton. The next 2 months, Hitler is coming to power. You know, it's impossible that Soloveitchik was unaware of Freud's presence. And I think there's a case to be made very strongly that he's really reacting to him.
In disagreement.
Yes, in disagreement. I think Soloveitchik misunderstands Freud in some ways, but that's again an argument in the book. But yes, I think most people in the yeshiva world, and not only YU graduates, would find the invocation of Freud to be problematic and troubling, and I understand that. But to me, it's a useful lens. Yeah.
Do you think that there's a fundamental problem with the obsession that modern-day yeshivot have with learning the Rav's and the Priska method that it might lead to, might be drawn into a melancholic way and question?
I always wondered when I first came to the yeshiva, I thought, wow. And I told you I was in graduate school and was really interested in pluralism, and I thought, I go to Beis Medrash, and all these guys are arguing with each other. And you would think that would have, like the Gemara in Kedushin says, that learning is a refuah, that it helps people individually and communally. And I thought, wow, this is exactly what I'm looking for, this communal Beit Midrash. And yet, everybody I knew there had fundamentalist ideas about truth. I think that has very much to do with this brisk conception of learning. That somehow there, even though the whole process is just that, a process, that dynamic somehow doesn't translate in people's heads.
From outside the yeshiva world, one of the criticisms of YU, as I understand it, and perhaps Soloveitchik because he was one of the founders, is that they compartmentalize their mind.
They're bifurcated. That's
the
word.
Way of putting right. it. There's modernism, I think, that right. you were referring to. And there's tradition. And it's very hard to really synthesize the two. Mm-hmm. Do you think maybe this is what led to his melancholy? And isn't this one of the major problems
I think
of
that's
modern
what,
Orthodoxy?
I think that's what led to his Talmidim's melancholy, because Soloveitchik is performing a kind of synthesis, which I don't even know if it is synthesis. You know, he's just using his brain, and his brain has been exposed to jillions of different things. And I think, as Norman Lamb says, you know, Toro Mada, which is just like a slogan, now it's just a slogan for like an economic lifestyle, but Toro Mada is a risky business, right? It's risky. And, you know, those who talk about synthesis, I think synthesis is understood through the lens of the halachic man as man of conquest, meaning we can know everything, you know? I teach Milton and other stuff. It's not so easy to synthesize, right? It's a lot of work. You know, let's have our eighth graders read Romeo and Juliet. Seriously? I mean, it's a play about sex and violence. I'm just saying that there are risks involved in, you know, people who talk about synthesis glibly whitewash Western culture. It's challenging. Does things that are difficult. Maybe just one more, yeah.
Well, Soloveitchik was communing in a way in, let's say, three areas, namely Zionism,
women's learning.
Learning, and secular studies.
There you go.
Those things were so big.
And I agree.
They were a break from his family, so yeah. Maybe he wasn't innovative in other ways because yeah. It was such a big thing to just.
I think Rabbi Cardozo was the locus of that argument, not me so much.
I would agree with that. He was hiding somewhere behind certain forms of fundamentalism to allow the other things to take place without getting too much into trouble.
Just want a closing note. First of all, I want to thank you all for coming. I want to thank Rabbi Cardozo, as always, for hosting this evening. I want to thank my colleagues at Torah in Motion for helping support the evening. If you're interested more in the work we do, please check out our website. We are actually offering trips now around the world, which are fantastic trips. So if you go on the website, look at Torah in Motion Summer Trips, and I think they'll be of great interest. And last but not least, of course, I want to really thank my friend Bill Kohlbrenner for a really engaging evening. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you. That was really great. Thank you. Really, really great.
Thank you.